this event was such that I, for a second I thought that I had the paparazzi following me. You know, it became a little bit... anyway, I...
There's a cup of water.
No, it's okay. Thank you very much. I'm in enough hot water as it is already. This lecture.
Rabbi, would it help you if we just put that light on there?
The light? No, oops, I think I'm okay. I'd like to thank everybody for inviting me this evening, for Rabbi Zaitzik for inviting me this evening, and for the opportunity to address everybody and to talk about something that I'm very passionate about, or I'd like to be passionate about. I feel very strongly that connection that I have with Rabbi Zaitzik. I remember as a single student before I got married, eating in his home and partaking of the hospitality of his wife and himself, as a young boy and a young man and being very so positively influenced and inspired by his dedication at that relatively young age to Torah and to spreading Torah. And he's taking that passion and he's making his life work at great personal sacrifice, for all these many years. And to me, I find it so incredibly inspiring. I also like to acknowledge, my good friends. I call them friends. Yes, they're in a class that I give on Friday nights, but they're Yedid Nefashos of mine. They're close friends, Larry and Yaakov, who came here this evening. Truth of the matter is, on Friday night, when they said, when I mentioned that they mentioned or reminded me about the lecture, I said, I'm going to need some cues. You know, maybe I'll give you some cues, some subtle cues, because if I crack a joke, to tell people when to laugh. So I was thinking about it, and so I decided, maybe it's not such a bad idea. So I came up with a few ideas. I have one over here already. Okay, except it gets very, very, otherwise it gets a little bit. And then I realized that there's one cue that I will have to be like a little bit more direct communication. So I came up with this paper plane over here, which I could throw directly at him, which if it really gets boring, says, wake up. So, but I really don't want to disturb anybody's. Nap. But hopefully we'll have something that will be interesting to everybody. The title of this lecture is supposed to be "The Challenge of Empathy Within a Culture of Indifference." But empathy is becoming a rarer commodity in this day and age. People are not as sympathetic as they used to be. I remember in high school, I had once that Yom Kippur came out on Shabbos. And of course, on Yom Kippur, we can't write. And Yom Kippur, a Sabbath observer is not supposed to write. And here it is, we were in class on Thursday afternoon. And we had this teacher, an English teacher, his name was Mr. Connolly. And he looked as Irish as they can get, with ruddy complexion and red hair, and he was a real, real Irishman, great teacher. And he was very much up, though, on Jewish topics, and he knew what was flying. He used to read the Jewish press, and I guess he wanted to be in sync with us a little bit. And here was Thursday afternoon, and he turns to us and he says, "Listen, I have an assignment for you," and he gives us this humongous assignment. Now, As students, we wouldn't be doing the work on Shabbos anyway, but, Thursday and Sunday. But as students and normal students, we always look for reasons and excuses to get out of the work. So we said to Mr. Connolly, what are you doing to us? You can't give us this assignment. It's Yom Kippur. We're going to be in shul all day. We're going to be fasting. How can we do this? On Yom Kippur, you're going to give us an assignment, a homework assignment like this? See, he looked at us and said, "Gentlemen, for you, it may be Yom Kippur, but for me, it's just a regular Shabbos." And he walked out of the classroom. So, no sympathy. And, it's hard. It's hard. we live in a world that's become, has increasingly anesthetized and become anesthetized and dulled, and they don't really, the capacity to empathize has really diminished quite a bit. And I'd like to discuss for a moment, there's a number, many of reasons for a few minutes, there's many reasons for this. We are barraged by images in the media that, you know, deaden our sensitivities. How does this work? How does it work? Chazal tell us that one of the first nations to attack us when we came out of Mitzrayim, when we came out of Egypt, we were invincible in the eyes of the world. Here we are, this nation, it was the only nation or the only group of people that ever left Egypt. We had, the world knew about the terrible plagues that had been, that had befallen upon them. They knew what happened at the Red Sea, where the Red Sea had split for us and then it had collapsed on them. And God's divine protection was obvious to all. And nobody was about to come forward and dare attack us. And Amalek came forward and they attacked us. And when they attacked us, they ended up hurting us a little bit. They tried to attack us in our weak points, but they ended up getting beaten very badly. And yet, Chazal, our rabbis, teach us that they were compared to somebody who jumps into a hot bath, a scalding hot bath, and he gets burned very, very badly. But he cooled off the bath for everybody else. So the result was that everybody saw that we were attackable. Now, if you think about it for a second, what's the message? You know, what's the message that should have been about this story? The message should have been that crime doesn't pay. You attack, you got hurt, you got burnt, you know, don't start up with them. But the image screams that the unthinkable is really possible. And the truth of the matter is that possible then progresses, or should I say regresses, into acceptable. And eventually our shudders are replaced with drugs. And that's really what happens. We're very much affected by the images that we see. And if we see a world that's indifferent, if those are the images that we're confronted with, so then, you know, we eventually reach the point of saying, well, that's the way the world is, and that's it. Recently, I came across a children's comic. It's a serial children's comic that they tell a story over a series of weeks, and it's written by a very well-meaning Jewish, you know, it's a comic illustrator. And he tells a story that has a moral to it and a positive values that are taught. And this particular story that he was telling, I just had only read this one episode because I came across this paper. It talks about a young boy who fell into a bad crowd and he started stealing and doing things that were inappropriate. And where I come into the story is he decided, he was, somebody talked to him and he promised he's going to do better and he's going to get better, but he didn't have any money anymore to, you know, for his habits or for his cravings for nice things and delicacies. So he decides, I'm not going to steal anymore, so I'm going to get a job. So he starts going to different places on the other side of town where they don't know him, and he's going to try to get a job. And you have in the illustration people who are the upright citizens of this, you know, to our shopkeepers on the other side of town, who are obviously people who are not, you know, they're not people who are not, you know, who are supposed to be the upstanding, you know, members of the community. Goes to the butcher and he asks the butcher for a job. So the comic strip says, "Hey, you, my helper? Ha! Very funny. Why should I hire you? What do you know about being a butcher's helper? Sorry, Sonny, I can't use you. Besides, I'm not hiring now." And you have, it goes to the next guy. The next guy is a baker. The baker is a little bit more empathetic. Oh, your name is Shraga. Ah, yes, you must be the son of the famous charity giver. Oh, I remember him very well. It's so sad what happened to him in his old age. He lost all his wealth, became very poor, and he died before you were born. I'm sorry, though. I knew your father very well, but I can't help you. You don't have enough experience. A little more gentle. And then he goes to the grocer, and again, you're serious, right? Listen, and come back when you're older, taller, and strong enough to carry these large sacks of flour. And, of course, the boy walks away dejected. And I read this, and I said to myself, is this the, you know, if you're talking about the thieves and the, you know, the ruffians that he of the crowd he fell into are talking in a rough manner like that, in a sarcastic manner, in a deprecating manner like that. I can understand it. But these are a child reading this comic strip sees that the supposedly upright standing people in the community are talking this way. Says that, I thought to myself, is that the model that we have, what we want to model to our children, even in the context of a comic strip? I happened to speak to the author a little bit about it. He said, well, you have to understand the whole story and what he wants to portray. And later on in the story, as the serial comes out, I asked a couple of people what they thought about it. And you know, their reaction was not totally surprised. Well, look, that's the way the real world is. That's the way it is. You know, you can't, that's the real world. You know, you're going to hide somebody, you're going to shelter somebody from the real world. And my feeling, you know, is that to a certain extent, children will have the opportunity to be exposed to the real world very, very soon. And when in their developing stages, as much as possible, those who are in the position of people who they look up to have to be exemplary in terms of what they model to them, or what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. If they see sarcasm, if they see people putting people down, and these people are people that are supposed to be respected people in the community, well, that's what they're going to learn is acceptable too, and that's what they're going to model. Let's move on. The world, and the media particularly, often employs euphemism to sensitize and desensitize us about events that really should assault our sensibilities and evoke empathy within us. The Nazi propaganda machine, led by, I think it was Hermann Goebbels, he perfected euphemism in the modern era. There was an article by Dr. Benjamin Bleich recently that I saw. And he discusses one thing. He discusses, you know, discusses Kristallnacht. And he talks about what happened over there. We all know at least 96 Jews were killed, hundreds more injured, 7,500 Jewish businesses were destroyed, 30,000 Jews were arrested and sent to concentration camps, many never to return alive to their loved ones. It was what was considered the beginning of the Holocaust. They called it, the Germans called it Kristallnacht. He says, how, after all, were the Nazis able to commit their crimes under the veneer of civilized respectability? He says, upon analysis, the answer is very obvious. They glorified the principle of murder by euphemism. They had all special kinds of words. Sonderhandlung, special treatment, that was gassing. Euthanasia was the polite way to speak of the mass murder of retarded and physically handicapped patients. The man by the name of Quentin Crisp, he brilliantly put it, unpleasant truths wearing diplomatic cologne is what euphemisms are. And he talks about the fact that we have to understand that Kristallnacht was a euphemism too. You know, it's that Kristallnacht is just a word that implies broken glass. It was broken glass. It takes into account only the loss of crystal, and you know it's the how he puts it, it's the loss of crystal, as if the only terrible thing that happened was breakage of a tremendous amount of glass that would have to be replaced. A financial loss caused by wasteful vandalism that the government subsequently dealt with by taxing the Jewish community to pay for the damages inflicted upon themselves. So that's what Kristallnacht is. And he made a suggestion in this article that really we should call it, instead of Kristallnacht, we should call it Cain's Nacht. Because Cain, the night of Cain, because he was the very first murderer at the beginning of time. And he was cursed by God and condemned to carry the mark of Cain on his forehead for the rest of his life. So it's these euphemisms, you know, are something that carry on into our day and age and the life that we're living in. And we often sanitize things that really we should be feel tremendously by, you know, words that sort of like relegate them into something that's not really so serious. Often the behavior, speech, the reactions of important personages reinforce our indifference and a lack of sensitivity towards the feelings of others. I was very much taken by the Jordanian prime minister, by the Har Nof massacre, which you referred to before, where they entered into a synagogue. I'm sure everybody here knows about it, and they slaughtered so many people. I know about it. I have a lot of personal accounts about it, because one of our students in our school, his grandfather, we davened in that shul, we praised in that shul every single day. That morning, and here you have to see how the hand of God sometimes works in mysterious ways. He's an older man, and he goes there by cab. And for some reason, the cab didn't show up. And he called again, and the cab didn't show up. And finally, his wife says to him, "Listen, it's getting late. Don't forget about it today." And he missed the whole thing. This man, Rav Kalman Levine, who taught my son the laws that he needed to know when he got married as a groom, was one of those who was killed in that massacre. There's another individual who frequented a study hall that my son often studied in. So also my son knew him too. Was also killed in there. Jordan's Prime Minister Abdel Nasser on Friday sent a letter of condolences to the families of Ghassan Abu Jamal and Uday Abu Jamal, the two terrorists who murdered 5 people in a synagogue in Jerusalem this week. "I ask that Allah surround them with mercy and give you all patience, solace, and recovery from your grief," he wrote in a letter. And this letter comes 2 days after Jordan's parliament offered a prayer in honor of the spirit of the two terrorists. The MP, Khalil Atiyah, requested that they recite the Fatiha, the first chapter of the Quran, for the spirit of the heroes. And he declared that the murders in the Jerusalem synagogue were a natural reaction to the occupation crimes against the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Palestinians. Now, I really didn't expect much more from Prime Minister of Jordan, but I was thinking about how this contrasts so much with the ideals that the Torah teaches us, because even given, let's say, there would be a right reason for the action that was taken, which of course I can't imagine a right reason, but if some perverted mind would come up with a right reason, but why not any feeling of empathy, of pain at those who were the innocent victims of this political struggle? How does the Torah view it when we have to pain somebody else and rightfully paid somebody else, because in their perspective, you have to understand, they have a right to, you know, this is they're rightfully doing what they're supposed to be doing. But how does the Torah view that? The Torah, one of the laws on Pesach, on Passover, we recite Hallel. And Hallel is songs of praise to HaKadosh Baruch, to Hashem, to God, for all the things, the wonderful things that He did and the miracles that he wrought on that holy holiday. And yet, we don't recite the full Hallel. We don't recite all the praises on Hallel. Why? Because in the course of our liberation from Egypt, a nation which took the babies from their mothers and threw them in the brick walls, threw them in the Nile. It was genocide. It was just a different type of genocide. It was a genocide in a different era. But that nation suffered at the end, and there were many, many Egyptians who ended up having to die in the night of the firstborn. Many Egyptians died when they got inundated by the Red Sea, which turned back on them. When they were chasing us to try to annihilate us. And because God's creatures had to die in the course of our liberation, we, 3,000 years later, don't sing all of the Hallel, because we're supposed to feel the pain when God's creations die. And God's creations have to suffer, even if they deserve it. This is the contrast of what the Jewish perspective is on this, and what the world's perspective, or at least a large part of the world's perspective. I remember very vividly many years ago when I was a student in Yeshiva Chavetz Chaim Rabbinical Seminary of America in Forest Hills. We were having a big problem for a period of time. There were a lot of anti-Semitic older teenagers in the neighborhood that were harassing and hurting the younger students, particularly that we had a high school in the same building, and they were hurting them and giving them, they were really physically abusing them. And it reached a point where it became dangerous for the students to play in the schoolyard, and they were chasing them back to the school, and it was really unbridled aggression. And the Rosh Yeshiva, his blessed memory, Rabbi Henoch Leibowitz, said, "Look, the police are not responding when we call. Nothing is being done. The only thing sometimes some people understand is a little bit of their own medicine. And you're not obligated just to stand by idly when people are trying to hurt you. And so therefore, if they come again, you're going to have to fight back and teach them a lesson." And it was really almost comical because, you know, we weren't exactly arming ourselves, but we did have the... there used to be extensions for the bunk beds in the school, and they cut them in half, and so we had some kind of sticks that we could go and attack with. And one day they chased the kid all the way into the building, and there was about 15 of them chasing this kid from the high school into the building. And you have to picture the door of the building. The door of the building had these little windows, and so you really couldn't see too much looking inside, be able to see out. So the executive director, Rabbi Avram Ginsberg, of blessed memory, he went outside to talk to them. And he talked to his kids, and he said, "Look," he says, "what are you doing?" He says, "Don't do this anymore. Don't fight with us, the children in the school anymore. Don't attack them. Why can't we live in peace?" And he tried to talk to them. And instead of acquiescing, instead of being nice about it, they started to push him. And it got to the point where they were going to hurt him. And so he gave the single. What those kids didn't know is that there was 150 young adults standing behind those doors with the small windows, and coming from the back of the building and from the side of the building. And we poured out of the building. And we gave them a licking. We really beat them up. And I never forget, I remember there was one kid there, used to call him Flathead. And I saw him there standing there, he was distracted. And I went with my hand like this and went, and I missed totally. And I said to myself, thank God, because if he would have caught me in the street afterwards, he would have beat the daylight out of me. But the bottom line is, we really, really gave them a lesson. Nothing, no serious injuries. And after that, we didn't have a problem from them, because after that, they understood that if they're going to start up with us, we're going to stand up for our rights and we're going to fight back. But I'll never forget that the next day, the Rosh HaYeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, Rabbi Leibowitz, got up from the lectern and he talked to us. And he said, gentlemen, you had to do what you do. But he, well, of course, always he always used to quote and used to quote from the sources from the Torah. He says, you had to do what you do. You did. But you have to feel bad about it. You have to feel sorry. You have to feel pain. That you had to inflict pain. Because that's the Jewish way. Let's move on. Another thing that affects us, is again, it's the whole atmosphere in society. We have these national political roasts, right? So is it good-natured fun, or does it really also convey another message as well? As long as it's funny, it's okay to ridicule. It's a way to speak Lashon Hara. It's a way to make fun of a person. And sometimes you don't know, even though the person is the object of the roast, but you really don't know which buttons are being pushed and really, really where it really can sometimes be very painful. And more importantly, as the message goes, is that it's okay for us to do it too, because that's, that's the in thing. That's what you do. We roast people. So let's discuss, let's move on. And I want to just say that there's one other, perhaps the most important cause and the most important reason of behind our decline and our regression in our ability to empathize and feel the pain and embarrassment is because of due to the unprecedented preoccupation that we have today with ourselves. It just invades our society. I don't know if it's still in vogue. They call it the me society, the I society, but that's really what it is. We live in an environment where, we hear all the cliches. You got to look out for number one. Or it's a dog eat dog world. And what I consider is perhaps the most damaging is that expression that nice guys finish last. How often do I hear that nice guys finish last? Because that implies that not only do you have to look out for yourself, but it's wrong to look out for the other guy. It's be nice to others. If you do, you're going to suffer in the end. So, nice guys, they finish last. It's a very, very, it's a message that I don't think, that I think affects us also very much and desensitizes us. So, what does the Torah say about this? What does it say in Pirkei Avos? It says, "Ein ani li mili." On the other hand, look, you have to look out for yourself. The Torah does say that. "Ein ani li mili." But the other half, if I am not for myself, that means if I am not for myself, who will be for me? But the other half of that sentence is "Ukesha ani la atzmi mo'ani." If I'm only for myself, what am I? Where's my essence? What am I about? Now, you might think that, there are many people out here, as I'm sure amongst us, that are thoughtful and considerate. We've all come across a lot of people. We come across them all the time, and we have, it's association with people all the time who are considerate and thoughtful, and it's true. But the challenge for us is really to focus, is to be able to grow and to raise the sensitivity to a higher plateau, and especially in situations where our own needs and our own wants conflict with the needs of others, that's where it becomes much more of a challenge for us to be able to look at the other person's needs and the other person's wants and to be able to take that into consideration and take into consideration the pain that a person may have, as I, perhaps might myself want to get ahead. I wanted to share with you. I wanted to share with you a thought, and that is that even when it's appropriate and correct to take action with somebody that will impact on him negatively, we are held accountable if we don't feel feel their pain that we need to inflict upon them. And I want to share with you, to me it's a little bit of a frightening chazal. I don't have the sefer here, but I know it pretty much by heart. Torah relates to us that we read it a few weeks ago in Toldos, Pashas Toldos, that Esav was the brother of Yaakov, was the firstborn. He sold the right to the firstborn, to his brother, the right of all the privileges of being the progenitor of the rest of the Jewish people for a pot of soup. But the Torah relates us that he really didn't deserve it. His actions and his mode of behavior in life didn't make him suitable to be the one who was going to, from which the Jewish people and the Jewish nation, which is supposed to be a light unto the nations, to come out of. So he sold it, and then the time came for his father to bless Yaakov, or to bless the firstborn, and with all the blessings that had been bestowed upon him by his father Abraham. And Rivka, who was Yitzchak, Isaac was the son of Abraham, and he was going to bestow the blessings on his son Esav. And he called him and he told him, you know, go and go out and buy, you know, and hunt for me or trap for me an animal that I could have a good meal, because when a person is satisfied physically and so forth, he's in that affects a person's mood and affects him and gives him a certain sense of simcha and joy, and they come and come back and I'm going to bless you, because we're made up of neshama, of soul and physicality, and so we have to. Torah wants us to be able to address and satisfy both of those in a positive way. And so he went out, and his mother, Rivka, she told Hassan Yaakov, quick, I'm going to supply you with two kids, two lambs, and you're going to prepare them, and you're going to take the blessings from your brother, because that's what God wants. His mother forced him to do it. And Torah relates that he went to his father and he was crying that he had to do this, but he went and listened to his mother. His mother herself was a prophetess, and she knew that this was the right thing to do, and he stole the blessings. Yaakov, he came before his brother, and his father gave the blessings to him and not to Esav. Later on, his father, when Esav came, he let out a loud and bitter cry. Cried out a big tzaka gadola ad ma'od, big and mora ad ma'od, very bitter. And he told his father, oh, he swindled me twice. His father asked him, what do you mean he swindled me twice? And he told him, well, first he cheated me twice, or he outwitted me twice. You know, first he convinced me to sell him the birthright, and then now, you know, he stole the blessings from me. So his father said to himself, ah. All right, that's what I was worried about. I was worried that perhaps I gave the blessings to the wrong person. But now that you told me that you sold your rights to it, so now I'm not so upset with myself. But he let out this bitter cry, and the Torah relates to us, and the Medrash relates to us, that we ended up paying a price for that cry. Hundreds of years later, in the time of Purim, when Achashverosh and Haman wanted to destroy the Jewish people. And the Torah uses, or the Megillah uses, the exact same expression that they let out a Zaka Gadola Mara Admaod, that we let out a loud and bitter cry. And the reason why that wording was used is because the cry that we caused Esav, or that that Yaakov calls Esav so many years earlier when he took the blessings from him had to be paid back. The pain that he had to be paid back in the time of Purim many, many years later. And we had to be paid at one point, and so therefore we had to suffer a pain and a worry and an anguish that caused us to cry out. And the question that begs, and the question that was asked was, what's going on over here? Did Yaakov do anything wrong? He was supposed to get the blessings. He bought them legitimately. Esav didn't deserve them. His mother forced him. And he did it so reluctantly. He was crying at the time. So why did we have to pay a price for that? And Rav David Leibowitz actually explained, that was Rav Hanoch Leibowitz's father, blessed memory, says that the reason why is because as much pain as he felt on some level, some infinitesimal level, Yaakov didn't feel enough pain that he had to paint his brother like that. So he was obligated to feel the tsar. Yes, I have to take the blessings away from you. I have to steal the blessings away. I have to listen to my mother because she's right in this situation. It's the right thing to do. But I have to feel the pain too. The Torah tells us something else. That later on, he hid his daughter Dinah in a box, so that Esav wouldn't see her, and he wouldn't want to marry her, and he was punished. But later on, because of that, Dinah was ravished in Shechem. And again, the question begs, but it was the right thing. Why should she want his daughter? It was not the right thing to give his daughter over to somebody who was a Russia, a wicked person, such as Esav. And again, this answer was given by the author of Slobodka, said yes, he had to put her in that teva, in that box, but he knocked the nails in too hard. In other words, there was something on some level lacking in his sensitivity that this is what he has to do, that he can't give his daughter to his brother. So this is the Jewish perspective of how we have to view our need sometimes to give tzad to others. It's so different from the world's perspective. Now, how far? Maybe can I turn on this light?
Yeah, we have to
hit
the switch.
It's
a timer.
All right, forget it. All right, it's not a problem. So, I'm having a lot more senior moments, and now not senior moments, but also senior symptoms these days. And one of the things is that I need more light to see. So, the question is, how far does the need go to empathetic go? So, we see from the lives of our great Torah leaders, we see things that are instructive in this subject. What tools can we use to work on ourselves and improve ourselves in this area? So, one of the things that I wanted to point out is that not only do we need to be sensitive to the needs and feelings of others, but ideally we need to react to others, and we need to, when the need presents us, we need to react to other people, and we also have to anticipate the needs. And I just want to tell you two little stories that will illustrate this. Reb Chaim Kanievsky is one of the great Torah leaders, lives in Bnei Brak in Jerusalem. And a certain man observed him going into a store where before the holiday of Sukkot, where you buy a lulav and esrog, the palm branch which we shake, and he went into that store, and the proprietor of the store showed him the different palm branches were there, and there's special laws about how the palm branch has to be in terms of not split at the top, it's supposed to be straight, and there's very specific laws. And Rav Kanievsky is a very, very great man and a very holy man, and he definitely wanted to be careful to pick out the right one. And sometimes it could take a long time to find the right lulav, or to find the right esrog. And to the person's astonishment, he was there for maybe less than 10 minutes, picked out a lulav, paid for it, and walked out. So he was wondering, and his son-in-law, Rav Chaim Kanievsky's son-in-law, was with him. So the man went over to him. He says, wondering, he says, you know, it takes me so long to pick out a lulav. How is it? It's unbelievable providence that he was able to find and accept a lulav for him in 10 minutes. That's incredible. So son-in-law says, come with me to the house. They come to the house over there, and they come upstairs, and there on the table, the man sees about 15... just numerous, laid on the table, lulavim, these palm branches laid out. He says, what's going on over here? So he says, you don't understand. He says, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and the Pesach Kron tells over this story. He says, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he knows that he is looked up to by the entire Jewish population, religious population in Bnei Brak. And if he would go into a store and look at the lulavim there, look at the palm branches, and not buy one, people will say, probably he doesn't have good merchandise. So every store that he goes into in his search for a proper lulav, he buys one, so that the proprietor won't suffer, that people won't shop by him. I want to tell you another story, that in terms of anticipating, the Brisker Rav was also a very great rabbi. A man once came to him on the eve of Passover and said to him, please, Rabbi, tell me, would it be permissible for me to conduct the Pesach, the Passover Seder, with instead of using wine, the four cups of wine, can I use milk? So he contemplated, and then he gave the man money to buy wine and to buy matzah, and to buy meat. And after the man left, he wasn't a wealthy man, he didn't have lots of funds at his disposal, people close to the Brisker Rav asked him, he said, why? I understand you want to give him money for wine because you saw he didn't have wine. He was going to make the Seder using milk. So he looked at him, he said, think. If he was going to use milk, observant Jews don't drink milk and eat meat. If he was going to use milk, he probably didn't have money for meat either. So I gave him money for meat as well. That's called thinking into the needs and anticipating the needs of the other person, even if it's not so readily apparent. I was very, very moved by a story about a certain, you may have heard about Rav Aryeh Levine, he was the tzaddik of Yerushalayim. He was a very famous, very righteous individual. But he had a brother, his name was Reuven Levine. There's a very sad story about a young couple that couldn't have children for many, many years. And finally, after many years, they had a child. And I think it was at 1 month, very shortly after the child was born, the father passed away. It wasn't long after that that the mother took ill. For 10 years she raised that child single-handedly. And after 10 years she took ill. And it was something that was terminal. And she was beside herself. This was the apple of her eye. The child already had certain emotional problems because of the difficulties of growing up in a household without a father figure. And she didn't know what to do. What's going to happen after she passes on? In desperation, she went to the house of Rav Alyoshev Zatzal, who just passed away recently. And she poured out her heart to the Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin Alyoshev, to Rav Alyoshev's wife. And she promised her that she will take after and she'll look after her son. The name of the son was, the name of the family was Briskman. The name of the boy was little Moshe Briskman. It wasn't soon after that that she passed away. and they placed the child into a foster home or an orphanage. And she told him that any time you want, you can come to my house. And right after the shiva was over, they came to the period of mourning was over. The little boy came to her house, Rabbi Yoshua's house, on a Saturday night, and her brother-in-law was Rabbi Rafael Levine, Rabbi Levine's brother, an older man, very older man, but a very warm man. And she had a brilliant idea. She said, maybe you'll study a little bit on Saturday nights when he comes to visit me. Maybe you'll study, and we'll have some nice fresh cake and cake and tea, and you'll study with him a little bit. And he took it upon himself to do that. So he sat down and he studied with the boy, and it meant so much that this very, very distinguished holy rabbi, but that's what he was, Rabbi Rafael Levine, was taking the time to study with him. And after they finished studying, he says, now we need to dance. And he gathered some people in the courtyard around him, and he started dancing with this little boy, and Reuven Levine dancing with him. And they danced together after they finished the studying. And this went on year after year. And it went on for, I think it was almost 10 years. And the time came, though, that even that light left this boy's life, because Reuven Levine passed on to the next world. Rafael Levine, his name was Rafael Levine. And so little Moshe Briskman was not so little anymore. He was living on his own. He wasn't in the orphanage anymore. He had nobody. And about a while later, maybe 2 years later, I don't know exactly how long it was, a few years later, there was one of those people who had been always part of, who had been frequented the Alyoshev house and had been part of that little dance that occurred every single Saturday night, happened to be attending a funeral in Meir Sha'arim. And from the distance, he heard his name being called, and this almost now 20-year-old Moshe Briskman was calling to him. And he looked at him, and the man said to him, Moshe, you don't look so well. He says, I miss Reuven Levine, Rafael Levine. I miss him. He used to learn with me. He used to study with me on Saturday nights. Did you study with me? So the man looked at me and says, yes, I'd be happy to. And they made up that he would pick him up at 9 p.m., the next Saturday night at his home. And when he came to the house and the door opened, and pardon if I'm afflicting your sensibilities, the stench in the house was overpowering. That, as sensitive as he was, he just almost like blurted out, almost like reflexively, what is that terrible smell? So he says, the toilets and things need to be cleaned. So he says, well, why haven't you been cleaning it? So he said, when Rafael Levine used to come Saturday nights to learn with me and to study with me, he used to clean the house. And since he passed on, nobody had to clean it. As an older man, I understand. His job was to learn with him, but he took it beyond that. I'll never forget, there was a person who you must remember, Rabbi Avraham Pernikoff. He was a teacher in Chavetz Chaim, the ninth grade teacher. He was a brilliant Torah scholar and in his own right. And he was not a healthy man. A little appreciation of him was written up a number of years ago about a former student of his who decided he was in the Lower East Side and he wanted to search him down. And it was a Friday morning. So someone told him, usually he goes visits this almana, this widow, who lives in this house on Grand Street. So he walks over to the apartment and starts climbing the steps up to the apartment, and the door to the apartment is open. And he hears this lady berating somebody and insulting somebody What's the matter with you? You're not doing a good job. You're messing up. How come you're not being more careful? And he walks over and he walks up. And there is Rav Avraham Pernikoff on his hands and knees scrubbing the floor while this lady is insulting and berating him. Now, a person is not supposed to be a doormat. A person is not supposed to allow people generally just to insult them and hurt them and not respond. But obviously, Rav Pernikoff estimated that this person's own pain and her own suffering was such that this was something that was beyond her. She really wasn't. Her own dementia was not allowing her to act in a way that would be appropriate. So therefore, he dealt with it. I want to say that even when it's what can we focus on? What can we focus on to help us grow into more caring and gentle people? Am I okay with the time? Okay. There are a number of things that I would like to take this, because I would like to be able to walk away this evening with some really practical ideas that can help us to grow. Relate what's happening to somebody's, what's happening to somebody else to your own past experience can be a very powerful mechanism for us to be able to tap into what another person's feeling. I'll never forget many, many years ago, there was a young man studying in a seminary with us. His name was Peretz Zakkai, today Rabbi Peretz Zakkai. And all of a sudden, we were all called together into Rabbi Ginsburg's shul. There was a shul that was adjacent to the study hall, to say to him to recite Psalms, because Peretz had a newborn that suddenly took ill, and it was in danger of dying. And I remember saying to him, and all of a sudden I just burst out into uncontrollable tears. Nobody else was crying like that. I was crying, and I couldn't stop. And I thought to myself, why? I never did that before. It never happened to me before. And then I realized, not too much earlier, before, I don't know if it was within a few years of that, my son, Rafal, should live and be well, was born. And when he was born, he was born actually on the holiday of Sukkot. I saw everything was okay, and I went to go to say the morning service. This is born early in the morning. And when I came back, I found that he had gone onto oxygen, and then from a partial respirator to a full respirator, till the situation was such that as the end of Sukkot was winding down, basically the doctor said, look, it's 50-50. We can't tell you what's going to happen. And miraculously, right after Sukkot was over, right after Sukkot was over, after Simchas Torah, he did a 360 degree turnaround. Within one day almost, he was off almost all of the support. He had to stay for 3 weeks in the hospital, but it was miraculous that all of a sudden his lungs opened up and he was able to breathe on his own. So what happened was that I was relieving my nightmare. And so therefore, his tsar became my tsar. His pain became my pain. So one way is if a person can think about something that he himself went through and how he felt at that time, that's one way to tap in. Now, sometimes, even when a person doesn't have, personal experience to relate to, we can still create a kinship with the individual undergoing pain and hardship. They tell a story, by the way, just a little digression over here. They tell a story about a guy who rushes in to a dental surgeon. He says, doctor, he says, I need you to extract a wisdom tooth. But I'm in a big rush. You have to do it very quickly. So how long would it take? He says, it's going to take an hour and 15 minutes. hour, 15 minutes. I don't have, I have 45 minutes. I don't have an hour, 15 minutes. He says, I'm sorry. He says, the anesthesia itself is gonna take a half hour to take. He says, I can't. I don't care about the pain. I don't care about the pain. I just want you to do it. I'm in a rush. I don't care about the pain. You say, you're crazy? Do you understand what this is? Taking out a wisdom tooth is not a little thing. It's terribly painful. I don't care about the pain. Just do it. So the doctor says, look, it's your choice. If you want to, I'll do it. So the man turns, goes back into the waiting room, and his wife was waiting there. He says, darling, the doctor said he can do it in 45 minutes. Go into the dental chair. He's ready to start. So, sometimes, we don't create that kinship with the individual undergoing pain or hardship. But I just like to contrast that with Rabbi Aryeh Levine's brother. That it's a well-known story that he once went into the doctor's office with his wife. And when the doctor came out to see them, the doctor said, what's the matter? And he turned to the doctor and he said, my wife's foot is hurting us. And that's really a perspective which, we can achieve. And isn't that really what V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha is all about? Loving your fellow man as you love yourself is all about. That's what it's about. If we realize that, we're just like we wouldn't inflict pain to our own foot, well, every Jew, our fellow Jew, is like another part of us. That's how the Torah looks at it. One of the best ways to develop that sort of identification with our fellow man is realizing that this is what Hashem is all about. There's a mitzvah. I say that a positive command in Torah, vo tidbak, that a person is supposed to cling to God, supposed to attach himself to God. One of the ways, how do you do that? How do you attach? God is invisible. You can't physically touch God. So how do you attach yourself to God? So our rabbis tell us that one of the ways to do that is by emulating his ways. What are his midos? What are his character traits? Mahu rachum, afata rachum. If he's merciful, that's what you have to be. And when you do that, you touch godliness. You're touching God, because that's what God's essence is all about. And this is a central core of our avodas Hashem, of our service to God. It's the raison d'etre of our existence, is the reason we were put here. It's our tafkid b'chayim. And if we realize that, then developing empathy becomes a primary goal, because if that's what, we're going to put in the forefront of our minds, and our thought processes, because, we're going to be sensitive to act properly, because that's what we're putting in this world for. That becomes a priority to us. And, while I'm on that subject, we have to understand that this taps into benefits, because people don't do things generally because we are still, in essence, there's a lot of self-interest in it. But if we realize the benefits of something, so then it becomes easier for us to focus on that area that's going to benefit us. Before we get into the benefits, this idea of prioritizing, because we understand that it's important when we have something that's important. I knew we were going to have an election tonight. So today, when I was driving someplace this afternoon, and as I came to an intersection, there was a Dunkin' Donuts that had where the driveway out of the Dunkin' Donuts was there. And I was about 5 feet from a car. And there was a car that wanted to come out of the Dunkin' Donuts and come into the intersection. And I was in a rush, and I had things to do, and I still had to work on little thoughts that I had with the lecture and so forth. And I said, should I let the guy through, or should I not? Should I let him through or not? Well, I'm in a rush. Now, what about him? He's probably in a rush too. And Rabbi Sternberg, are you giving a lecture tonight on empathy? How would you feel if you were there and you tried to get out to the traffic and no one's letting you through? I know, but yeah, come on, he's probably not, he doesn't have as important things for me to do as I do. I have important things to do tonight. I'm busy, I'm running. He probably also has something very important to do. So finally I said, okay, it's in the forefront of my mind, because I have to give a lecture tonight on empathy. I let them through, and I'm a New York driver. As a matter of fact, I taught New York drivers how to be New York drivers. But you know, despite that, you know, I let the person through because I was focused on it. I read recently there was about a certain great rabbi who was asked to sign a letter, and the letter was. The sign-off for the letter that he was asked to sign, it was a mass letter that we asked many rabbis to sign on about a certain cause, was Hakasuv B'Dimos. This is signed in tears. So he got the letter, he read through the whole letter, and he had even helped form the format of the letter, the compilation of the letter, except for the sign-off. So when he saw the sign-off, he refused to sign it right away. And he sat there, and I think he even went into his room, and then he came out and signed it. And he said, I couldn't sign it right away because it said, signed in tears. And I didn't spend enough time focusing on this to cry over it. So for him, honesty, for me it was the fact that I had to give a lecture that put it as a focus. For him, his drive for honesty made him focus on it. When we realize that something is our main purpose for our existence, so then that's another reason for us to focus and develop empathy. The ultimate happiness that a person has in life, if a person really thinks about it, is when he feels he's living a life of purpose and meaning. And the realization, if we realize that by refining and improving ourselves and improving our character in life, we are fulfilling what God wants us to do in getting close to Him and emulating His ways, so then that can serve to us as a major inspiration for us to make major inroads in improving ourselves. Because this is something that's going to give me happiness. Not only is it going to give me happiness, but I'll tell you something else. Chazal tell us, the rabbis tell us, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu deals with a person the way He deals with others. If somebody has mercy, rachamim is mercy in Hebrew. If somebody has mercy on other people, is empathetic and feeling and caring towards other people. So God says that's the type of person when he messes up and when he perhaps does something that he perhaps should be dealt with in a way that a corrective way that to put him in his place. I'm going to deal with him. Sometimes it's good for us, but I'm going to deal with him with rachamim. I'm going to deal with him with mercy, because that person himself emulates that midah, that character in his own life. Now, sometimes a lack of empathy is due to a coping mechanism. Sometimes the pain is just too much to bear. How does one deal with that? My daughter-in-law, I was taking her practice driving the other day. It was right after the Harnov massacre. And at one point she stopped and was trying to teach her parallel parking. She said, I can't focus. Why? She says, because of what happened in Israel. So she was able to tap into that. I was wondering why I wasn't crying about the fact that I wasn't crying. I wasn't able to feel the way she felt. Sometimes, you know, it can be overpowering. My wife is an RN. And at one point, many, many years ago, she worked in oncology. And from the time she came onto the oncology floor to 6 months later, not one person was still alive from the patients she was treating. And she said to me one day, she says, I can't do it anymore. I can't, because she's a very feeling person. A caring person. She can't. I remember going to the Rosh Yeshiva of Hanukkah Leibowitz and asking him about this. And he said to us, he says, a person has the capacity, God created us with this inner capacity, to at the same time to be able to cope. Because he says, all the other nurses tell me, you got to turn yourself off. You got to just turn your mind off. You can't feel it. He says, no. He says, a person has the ability to compartmentalize himself, to still feel and not let it get to him. Part of it has to do with bitachon, trust in God, understanding that there's a world after this world, and that there's a reason for everything that happens. And so therefore, what seems to us as bad and terrible happening to somebody is not necessarily, you know, what it appears to be. He used to talk to us about the fact that there is a pain that paralyzes, and then there's a pain that galvanizes. He says, if it paralyzes us, that's the Yetzer Hara, that's the evil inclination. It's not supposed to paralyze us, it's supposed to galvanize us. Erev Shabbos, after the Har Nof massacre, one of the ways that a person can deal with this is to galvanize ourselves. Right after the Har Nof massacre, on that Erev Shabbos, the wives of four men who were killed, they sent out the following letter. I'm going to translate it to you in English. From hearts that are broken and dissolved with our tears, on the shedding of blood of these holy heads of our households, we turn to our brothers, all of those in the house of Israel, in every place. Come together, all of us, to influence the mercy of heaven. Let us accept upon ourselves to increase our love and our brotherhood between one man and his fellow man, being one community and another community, no matter if it's a different type of community or not. We ask that everybody makes the effort to accept upon themselves on the coming of this Shabbos, that was Shabbos Toldos, to sanctify this holy day, Parshas Toldos, to be a day, instead of unwarranted hatred, unwarranted love, Ahavas Chinam, free love, a day that we refrain from words of contentiousness and fighting, words of disparity and pitting one Jew against another. And this should be an elevation for the great souls of who are the heads, the fathers of our families that were slaughtered in the sanctification of God's name. May God look from above and see our situation and blot out and wipe away our tears. The Yom Adilat Sarasenu, and say enough to our pain. And may we be zocha, may we merit to see the coming of Mashiach, b'mheir v'meinu, amen v'mein. Signed with the hearts that are broken and shattered. Chaya Levin, Greiner, Goldberg, Yakova, can't be the name, and Bashi Tversky. So what they did was that they turned their pain, and at that moment of pain, they turned it into a positive energy. And instead of being bitter about it, they turned it into something positive. And that's what, by the way, Rabbi Levi's daughter said about her father. She says, I know there are people who want to take her. She was talking about her father on Oretz Sheva. It's a radio station in Israel. He says, my father was a man of truth and he implemented in actions love towards all humanity. I know the people who want to take revenge, but that's not the way of my father. He wouldn't have wanted vengeance in his name. I thank the whole nation of Israel that is with us in sorrow, and it's important for me that the message that comes out to all portions of the people be that my father didn't see whether it's religious, secular, leftist, and right-wingers. Be that my father didn't see a person according to their sector. He wanted contact with everyone through empathy. This is what the Torah very much teaches us about how we have to channel our pain and our sorrow and how we have to look at it. We have a couple minutes, yeah? Okay.
Yes.
It's getting late, I know.
Okay.
There exists a natural love for one's own children, and in a sense it's easier to develop empathy within our own families than, and then expand that capacity for love between our children to, other people, our circle of people with all of humanity. I tell you, having teenagers, though, sometimes challenges that a little bit. You know, it's a, it challenges the assumption, teenagers give us a glimpse of what, of the magnitude of the patience of God. You know, so from them we see what it's like to create something in your own image and then have it deny your own existence. So, since it is getting late, I wanted to talk a little bit about how it's important for us to focus on our own families as well. Sometimes our own families get lost in the shuffle in terms of our dealing with them. There was a story I was going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you now, but the synopsis was a little boy whose father sent him to his room because he asked his father, "How much do you make an hour?" And later on, when he found the boy crying and sobbing in his room, they went up there. His father and mother went up there to talk to him. He said, "Well," he says, you're always so busy." And his piggy bank was there when the night table opened up. He said, "I was thinking to myself that, you know, if I knew how much you earned an hour, maybe I could buy an hour of your time to have you spend it with me." So this is something that, you know, we have to focus on. You know, as Rabbi Dr. Goldman, I know that every single day when he used to come home in the evening, before he walked into the house, he used to stop and think to himself, "When I come into the house, dinner might not be ready. The house might be in disarray. Everything might be chaotic. How am I going to react to my wife's, having to deal with the kids up until now? Am I going to smile at my children? Am I going to listen to their stories? Am I going to help, calm the normal household chaos?" This is something that we need to focus on. Tefillah is another area that can help us focus on tefillah. Our praying that we do can help us focus on being sensitive to the needs of others. As so many of us have heard, and we know that the prayer service, the main prayer service, is in plural. It's not in singular. So when we ask for everything that we need, whether it's wisdom or health or livelihood or salvation for the Jewish people, it's all in plural. Because essentially, it's God wants us, when we're thinking about ourselves, to think for about others. And that's why the sages, when they set the format of the prayer service, it was done in the plural. There is it's very late. Okay, so I'm going to end off here. I just end up that I would urge anybody here to take to heart one thing that it says when it's talking about rachem and mercy in this book, Orchas Tzadikim, the Ways of the Righteous. So he says, people very often know how to give charity, but they don't know how to clothe their lips in a charitable way towards the heart of a poor person. And a person could be poor in many ways. It could be emotionally poor, it could be physically poor. And our words have to be gentle to every poor person and every person who's impoverished, to comfort him in his deeds, and from the sadness of his hands, give him honor and lift him up. And then he ends off, and this is what I want to end off with, because very often there's one person who we forget to have mercy on and to have rachmi on, and that's ourselves, in a certain following sense. Va'ata ben Adam, now you, son of man, terachem al nishmasecha, Have mercy on your own soul. Hameskeyemes la'adayat, that's going to live forever. Lahavi al tanig mufla, to bring it to an unbelievable pleasure. Asher lo asa ra'ayin, that no eye ever saw. V'lo yivacha roiv tavascha l'chet. Don't let your passions bring you to sin, and that thereby be pushed away from light to darkness. Chamol al atzmecha, have pity on yourself. V'chus al nafshecha, spare your souls. V'al techalal yekar ho nishmasecha, do not profane the majesty, the precious majesty of your souls with just trivial pursuits. What he's telling us over here is that we have the ability in this short term that we live in this world to grow. And the way we grow is by learning what the Torah expects of us and implementing it in our lives. And as we develop and we get closer and we develop these character traits of feeling mercy towards other people, feeling for their pain and sorrow, that's how we preserve the preciousness of our souls, and that's how we elevate ourselves, and that's how we have rachamim on ourselves, essentially, because we are tapping into godliness, and that's what God expects us, and that's why he put us in this world. Thank you.
Thank Rabbi Sternberg. I was trying to imagine while he was speaking what 18, 19-year-old young men who hear this sensitivity every day, what an influence this must have on his life. I'm very grateful to you. A very, very big yes, you got. I want to thank Janet and Gary for their wonderful hospitality, and everybody's invited to partake in the refreshments. Have a safe trip home. Have a wonderful, bright, enlightening Hanukkah.
Amen.